So welcome to this very special edition of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week, for the first time, we're going to leave World War One, and we're going to look at the story of a veteran from World War Two, a man called John Morris, who's now resident at the Royal Hospital in Chelsea. John is 101 years old, and a couple of weeks ago I was invited to go and talk to him for the podcast. He wanted to tell his story, and what an incredible story that he told me when we sat there in his room at the hospital there in Chelsea. He joined the Territorial Army when he was just 16, and then the Regular Army at 17, and initially served as an anti-aircraft gunner during the Blitz. He then went to North Africa with the Royal Artillery, and then he volunteered for a special unit called the Radiant Support Regiment, and this was part of the SAS. Later, he took part in the campaigns to liberate Italy and Yugoslavia. And during the interview, he tells me some incredible stories about how he was bullied at school as a 10-year-old, what it was like to be part of that anti-aircraft batteries defending London and Weston-super-Mare in Glasgow against German bombers. He explained what it was like to recover civilian dead from houses that had been bombed. And then he talks about his experience out in Africa and Italy and what it was like to be called a D-Day dodger. He's got a crystal clear memory, really defies the 101 years that he's lived so far. He talks about being taken prisoner of war by the Italians and how he escaped. But that's not all. When his military story ends, he escapes death again. And he tells us how he escaped from a ship that sunk and how a German sailor saved his three-year-old boy from the icy waters. So please keep listening once he starts talking about his civilian life, because that's just as incredible as his military life. And he ends up talking about how he feels about the World War II veterans, whether or not he was a hero. This really was an incredible experience for me. Obviously, when we talk about World War I, there are no veterans to talk to. There are not many veterans left from World War II. So it was a very important and very emotional day for me to sit there with John at his home at the Royal Hospital a couple of weeks ago and talk to him. And if you listen to the interview now, you'll see and hear how clear his memory was from a period in his life now 80-odd years ago. So what we've done today, we've come to the Royal Hospital in Chelsea, and we've come to meet one of the pensioners that's looked after here. John Morris, you're 101 at the moment, John, but I understand you're coming up to 102.
In April.
Yep. And you're the last surviving member of the Raiding Support Regiment.
Yes.
What
yes,
was that?
There were originally 400, I'm the last one left.
Right. So what was the Raiding Support Regiment?
It was a...
This is the Second World War, yeah?
It was a part of the Special Air Service group.
Right.
Actually, there was five. There were five in that. There was the SAS,
yeah,
SBS, Special Raiding Squadron,
yeah,
Popsie's Private Army. You've probably never heard of them, have you?
No, obviously.
You should look it up.
Yeah.
They were a crazy lot. They were. They were very much like the RDG.
Yeah.
And then there was the Raiding Support Regiment. Our job was heavy support for raids. In other words, when the SAS went on a raid or the LRDs went on a raid,
you were supporting them.
We supported with heavy armaments like 4 or 5 mortars, gun howitzers, anti-tank guns, mountain guns. We were there to support them.
Okay.
Our main job actually during the war was to support the partisans in Yugoslavia and Albania.
Right, okay. Let's go back before that then. Let's go back. Where were you from? And what year? What year were you born
Where
in?
Where am I from?
What year were you born in then?
1922.
So that makes you 102 this year.
Up in Lampen in Gloucestershire.
Okay, from the Cotswolds.
Up in the Cotswolds, yeah.
Yeah. But you were brought up in Kent from the age of 5, is that right?
And my father was had a rep company and... he's just performing at Lister's, a big factory in Lampen.
Yeah.
We moved there to Bournemouth.
Yeah.
For a while, stayed there a while, then we moved to Kent.
Yep.
A place called Waterslide.
Oh, right, yeah. But you got a bit bullied, you said, at school. You got a bit bullied at school, did you?
Well, did you?
And then you took up boxing and gave them a good
idea.
That's
right, yeah.
Yeah, that's probably the start of your fighting career.
Well, I decided that the only way to exist in life was to be strong yourself.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So
yeah.
It was on the secondary school, not the first school, when I was 12 and moved to the secondary school.
Yeah.
Which is I can't remember the village it was, just outside of Maidstone.
Yeah.
There were a very rough crowd of kids and they took advantage of anybody who came from a more select family.
Middle class, yeah.
And I got, because I wore glasses at the time, this particular person used to bully me.
Yeah.
Because he was about 2 years older than me. So I decided I'd had enough of that, so during the school holidays, I joined a boxing club in Gillingham.
Yeah.
And when I came back next time, he tried anything on me.
He gave him a good hiding.
Actually, he wanted to try to abuse me, actually, and I just gave him a damn good hiding.
Did you? You didn't do it again then, I bet.
Huh?
You didn't do it again?
He didn't do it again, no.
No. So then you left school at just 14?
14, yeah.
Yeah, your brother had joined the TA, and you decided to do that as well.
I joined the TA when I was 16 and a half.
Yeah.
A chap I was working with was a member of the TA and he enticed me to go and join, so I joined.
And that was in 1938, so a year before the Second World War. Yeah. So then September 39 comes around and the war
was
declared.
I was called up just before the war started, actually about a week before the war started.
Is that because they knew it was coming then? Yeah, and you were a trained soldier, so...
And unfortunately, England was very unprepared for war.
Yeah.
Because... all our army equipment was really 1914, 1918 stuff.
Right.
I mean, even the anti-aircraft guns were the old 3-inch ones with the wooden wheels. And that they're supposed to be mobile guns, but you had to stop every now and again to grease the wheels, otherwise they'd burn up.
It wouldn't work.
And we moved to a place called Sittingbourne.
Sittingbourne?
In a hop field.
Yeah.
Because that's
on the Kent coast.
In Kent, yeah.
Yeah.
Near Rochester.
Right.
That's
yeah.
where the planes were coming in.
Yeah. Know? So this is during the Blitz then?
That was in 1939.
Right.
And then, the September 39 when the war started.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in.
He said in the first week you saw a German bomber come flying over in the first week on a recce, was it?
A Dornier flying boat, yeah.
Yeah. And you fired at it, did you?
I opened sights, so I fired at it. Unfortunately, I didn't realise the kitchen chimney was in the way. And
so you got the kitchen chimney, not the Dornier?
The kitchen chimney, which ruined the breakfast for the boys.
You didn't
morning.
Get any breakfast that day, then?
And I missed bloody Dornier.
Okay, then. And then what happened when the following year, then, when the Germans were flying in for the Blitz?
Well, the Blitz started actually in...
September 40.
So it's the 1940 the Blitz started.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and they attacked
about.
And what's your experience of the Blitz?
Well, we were a mobile unit. Eventually, after the beginning of the war, the Labour Party had already started disarming us because Chamberlain came back waving his bit of paper saying.
Peace in our time.
Peace in our time.
Yeah.
And. He started disarming while Hitler was arming, we were disarming.
Yeah.
So when we got called up, we didn't have enough rifles to have a...
No.
Even the sentries didn't have enough rifles.
No.
So we had to have pickaxe handles.
Yeah.
That's how bad it was.
I remember my dad telling me he was in the Home Guard, the same problem.
The only problem was it didn't have enough uniforms for us. We had to use our own greatcoats because they couldn't supply us with greatcoats in the winter.
Were you expecting the Germans to invade?
Huh?
Were you expecting the Germans to invade England?
Well, everybody was expecting it then.
You were?
Because after Dunkirk, which was actually in 1940, as you know.
Yeah.
May to June 1940.
Yeah.
And I think something like 300,000...
330,000 they got off the
beaches. Evacuated from Dunkirk.
So they weren't an army, really, were they? Because they were out of action.
But it was a fantastic effort to get them back.
It was, yeah.
But, of course, we were in a complete disarray then. We had nothing.
And Britain was on its own. Mm. And how did you feel about that then? Were people
aware of it? At the time, as I say, I was busy just after Dunkirk, they started bombing London, as you know.
Yeah.
And of course, then we were in action mostly, probably up to 12 hours a day.
On trying to shoot them down. You were trying to shoot the bombers down, were you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We used to sleep by the guns.
Right. And this was still in Kent. Were you firing at them as they came in across the Kent coast?
Our job actually was to break the formations up so the fighters could get at them.
Right, yeah.
But of course, we were also machine gun and bombs dropped on us.
Really? Did you have any close shaves?
Stuka bombers.
Did you have any close shaves in that situation?
Well, everybody had close shaves.
Did you?
I was just lucky.
Right, yeah.
And we moved up and down towards London, different situations.
Yeah.
I finished up in Canvey Island.
Right.
And they put us right amongst the oil wells.
Right.
Which is a bit hairy, that.
Yeah, I'll bet, yeah. And they hit them, no doubt.
Bombers were trying to bomb the oil wells, and they... I know we slept in an empty railway carriage. And I suppose we was there for a few weeks. And then they transferred me to another unit because my unit went overseas.
Yeah.
Anyway, how far have we got?
So we get to 1943 and your new regiment.
They transferred me to the Essex Regiment.
Yeah. And they've gone overseas.
Heavy anti-aircraft regiment.
Yeah.
And we were moved up to Weston-super-Mare.
Okay.
And where the Germans were bombing Avonmouth and all around that area.
Yeah, the docks area.
And Weston-super-Mare was very heavily bombed, actually.
Oh, really?
And we were stuck right in the middle of that. And I remember we had to go out and pull the dead, wounded and dead people out of the houses.
Really?
Which was not very nice.
No.
And
these are civilians.
Then they moved us up to Glasgow.
Oh, blimey.
Because they were bombing the Clyde, trying to stop the ships going out.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were there on anti-craft defence up in Glasgow. Not very long after that, Operation Torch came. That was in 1942.
Yep.
I think it was September 42.
Okay.
And we were on Operation Torch.
And what was Operation Torch?
That was the North African landing.
Right.
It's the first time the Americans actually came into the war.
Yeah.
So they didn't come actually into the war till 1942, really.
Yeah.
Late 42.
Yeah.
And so England was really on its own for 2 years.
Mm.
We're fighting the Germans completely on our own.
Must have felt very isolated then.
Yeah. And we landed at Algiers. And particular section landed in a place called Bone.
Okay, and you're part of this then, are you?
Huh?
Are you you're there.
Unfortunately, the ship carrying the guns was torpedoed.
Right.
And lost all our guns.
Yeah.
We also lost a few men too, because they were, including one person. We were landing at Bone, and one of the main people who died on the ship coming over where the guns were lost, his name was Sergeant Bone.
Okay.
So unbelievable, isn't it?
Just a coincidence.
Yeah.
So you're on your way to Algeria and the ship is torpedoed, is it, your shop?
Torpedoed,
yeah. What's your memories of that?
Actually, Operation Torch was the biggest landing we ever during the war, apart from the D-Day.
Yeah.
It was a big landing.
Yeah.
Well, all the ships were sunk as well.
So this is ready for the Battle
of
El
Alamein. When we tried to get land on Algiers, we were attacked by the French.
The French attacked you?
Oh, they shelled us, yeah.
What, by mistake? They thought it was...
No, they did it on purpose.
Really? Why would they do that?
Because they joined the Germans.
Right. These are colonial French.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we sank three or four of their battleships anyway.
Really?
And then in Bone, of course, when we landed at Bone, we were getting air attacks all the time.
Yeah.
And because they didn't have any guns, I was also a trained brain gunner.
Yep.
And a signaller.
Yeah, radio operator.
And radio operator.
Yep.
They actually put me on top of a flat-top building where our battery was, and gave me twin brain guns. Not the single, that's twin brain guns, that's anti-aircraft.
Okay.
So my job was to try to fire at any dive bombers coming in.
These were Stukas?
Yeah.
What does that feel like? Because being a civilian, I don't know what that feels like.
Well, let's put it this way, I was a bit pissed off, actually, excuse my language. Everybody else is undercover except me and my mate who's up on this bloody flat top roof.
And were you scared?
Huh?
Were you scared?
No, I can't remember. I was a bit fed up in it because I remember going down into the garage and the captain actually was huddled in the corner.
Really?
Well, the air was going
on. He was scared, yeah. You don't know how you're going to react till you're there, do you, I suppose?
Anyway, we was there for about 6 weeks, I think, waiting for new guns to come. And I finally had to go to a hospital called hepatitis.
Yeah.
Because of the bad water.
Yeah.
And I was evacuated. I went to a hospital and then evacuated after the hospital to a transit camp in, I can't remember where it was, somewhere in Algiers.
Yeah.
Or Tunisia.
Yeah.
And while I was there, the Iranian support regiment came asking for volunteers.
You volunteered?
I was one of the first ones to volunteer for the regiment.
For this special unit called the Raiding Support Regiment for the SAS?
They were being designed to support the Special Air Service and other special units, special forces.
Mm.
And we moved up into Palestine for our training.
Yep.
Jumping out of the back of a lorry, travelling at 30 miles an hour to get used to doing forward rolls and everything like that.
This is prior to doing the parachute jumping.
And then we did five jumps out of a Wellington bomber through the bomb doors.
Yeah.
Because that's the only plane they had.
Was that scary? Were you frightened then doing that?
I was scared out of my bloody life.
I bet. But you volunteered for this though, didn't you?
Yeah. But I think I was pushed out my first one.
So they put a foot on your backside, did they?
I think I was sitting around this sort of well, bomb doors, five of you sitting around, dropping down.
Yeah.
But anyway, that...
So you went through the bottom of the plane, not outside.
Oh, through the bomb doors.
Through the bomb doors, yeah.
Eventually they changed to Hastings bombers, I think, where a long time after I had my jumps. But they were better anyway. They were through the side doors.
Right, yeah. So you're more controlled then, aren't you?
It was a bit hairy.
And that trained you for going to Italy, Operation Avalanche, Salerno.
Salerno, yeah. We went to Beirut, I think it was, and he kicked the Germans out of Beirut. And
that's in Libya?
In Libya,
yeah.
And then we went on, the next operation was Salerno landing in Italy.
Yeah.
Which is in November 1943.
So did you arrive on the beaches there or jumped out of an aeroplane?
On the beach, yeah.
You were on the beaches, were you?
Yeah, Salerno.
And what was that like? Can you remember?
That was very, let's put it this way. It was a very, very hairy experience, you know, especially because... There was a lot of big opposition. The Germans were very strong in that area.
And did you wade into the water off of landing crafts like this on D-Day?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
It was on landing craft.
Yeah, and they were shooting at you.
Yeah. Anyway, they called us the D-Day Dodgers.
Yeah. Because it was an Italian campaign.
Lady Mary Astor stood up in Parliament and called us D-Day Dodgers because we weren't on the Western Front.
Did you know that at the time?
It hadn't even started then.
But did you know that? Did you know that you were called that?
No, we weren't called it at the beginning. It's after the Western landing.
After the D-Day landing.
Which was later on. I mean,
yeah.
We were... Our landing was in November 1943.
D-Day is the following year. Isn't it?
And the D-Day was 1944.
So when you actually
we'd already been in operation in Italy for 6 months before Western.
So when you landed on those beaches at Salerno, what did you see? Can you remember what you saw?
Well, we saw a lot of Germans.
And what were they up on the beaches, or they?
No, they gave us tea and coffee. And,
but they had strong defences.
And a sing-song.
Yeah. Did you capture them or kill them or what happened? What happened when did you capture them or?
No, we just drove them out. It was quite a big landing, American and English landing.
Yeah.
And of course you had the Indian division as well, and the Canadians.
Yeah.
And Italy was a big operation, actually.
And did you end up at Monte Cassino?
No, I didn't. I went to Cassino as an observation.
Right.
Forward observation, but I didn't actually take part in the operation.
Right, right. That was probably a good thing, isn't it?
I was very pleased about that. But since then, of course, last year I had an opportunity to go to Cassino.
Yes, there's a photograph of you, isn't there, behind the bed here?
Yeah. And I was very impressed and very, very sad to see all the great graves and all that.
Mm.
Because there's actually 8,000 British and colonial troops killed in Cassino, 3,000 Poles in their cemetery, and 22,000 Germans in their cemetery.
Really? They got their own
all cemetery. In 3 months.
Yeah.
People who don't realise the modern warfare like Iraq and Afghanistan, I think in 20 years, only 700 British killed. In Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm. It seems a lot at the time, doesn't it?
40 in Australia were killed there in 20 years. That's 2 a year.
Yeah.
And we lost 8,000 in 3 months.
Yeah.
And the total casualties in Italy, I think, was 75,000 British and colonial troops killed.
Through the Italian campaign.
Italian campaign.
And did you lose some friends? You must have done. You must have lost some friends, yeah.
But we moved down to headquarters of the Special Air Service, or rather the Radio Support Regiment, was in Mola di Bari in east on the Adriatic coast.
Okay.
Where we did our operation through land forces Adriatic.
Yeah.
And we went on operations into Yugoslavia.
So you landed at Dubrovnik, yeah?
Went to Dubrovnik. In Albania and Greece.
Yeah. And you're joining up with the partisans?
Our job was supported the partisans, yes.
What were they like? Were they well trained?
Oh, they were good.
Yeah.
Actually, up in Montenegro, that was Tito's headquarters.
Yeah.
I was up there for about 6 weeks training
the girls.
Partisan girls how to use radio sets and how to teach a new code for them to use.
And it's you told me last time that you were sleeping in a big wooden cabin. And there was a partisan girl sleeping next to you with a load of hand grenades on her. What's that? Tell me about
that. They were all sleeping in this big wooden shed, men and women together. And I had a lovely, beautiful partisan girl sleeping next to me.
Yeah.
But she went to bed with hand grenades round her waist, so I mean,
was that just to keep you away or the enemy?
No, it kept me from doing anything. Apart from that, they'd already signed a bill of chastity. So they wouldn't have anything to do with men until after the war.
Right, and they kept to that. They were passionate about
it. But they were lovely girls and lovely people.
Yeah, can you imagine? And then you talk about a man called Blondie Smith that became
well, Blondie
a good friend
Smith
of yours.
Was LIDG.
Yeah.
That's when I was up in Montenegro.
Yeah.
He said to me one morning, he said, John, he said, was you like to come with me and pick up the Christmas mail in Dubrovnik.
Yeah.
So I asked my governor, I said, can I go with Blondie Smith, LRG, to pick up the mail for everybody? He said, yes, of course you can. So Blondie said, well, you ride shotgun, I drive. Because being a machine gunner, they put me in front of these twin Vickers. They're these twin Vickers on the Jeep.
Yeah, Vickers machine guns, yeah.
LRG, yeah. So we drove down to Dubrovnik. Unfortunately, we had a few too many rakias, which is a very strong Yugoslavian drink.
So one of you is in charge of a vehicle, the other one's got a couple of machine guns, and one of them's got a machine gun, one of them's driving the vehicle, and you both had too much to drink.
We had We had a few drinks, yeah.
What happened?
We lost our way coming back.
Did you?
Yeah. And we drove through a German village, unfortunately.
A German-occupied village?
Occupied, yeah.
Did they notice you?
And we saw these Germans there, and it was too late to turn around and go back. So Blondie said, fire your guns at them. He said, but don't kill anybody, it's Christmas Eve.
Fire over the heads?
He said, just fire over the heads. So I did that. They all scarpered, and we managed to get out of the village safely. Got back to our unit.
You've had a few close shaves, haven't you?
Oh, God, a few, yeah.
Cat with nine luck.
I've never seen such beautiful ladies in my life. They were absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, and you were only a young man, weren't you?
I was a very young man. Very old. And I was a virgin, too. But anyway, they were lovely.
Yeah.
And when we moved to Dubrovnik and up to Montenegro, where the partisans were active, very active against the Germans there, our job was to support the Germans, support the partisans
against the Germans,
to stop the Germans getting to the Russian front. They were evacuating Greece to get the Russian front.
Okay.
And our job was to stop them get their progress. And these partisan girls used to go out with the men fighting.
They're very brave, aren't they?
They weren't just passengers, they were actually soldiers.
Fighting. Yeah.
And they used to come back sometimes with blood streaming down them.
Really?
Wounded. And I was amazed. And so, you see, Yugoslavia was a very funny situation there. You had the Ustashi, which were Croatian fascists. They were on the German side.
Mm.
And they were worse than the Germans. They were more cruel.
Mm.
They were worse than the German SS.
Did you come across them at all?
Yes, I did. We actually fought them quite a lot before we moved up to Dubrovnik, out of Dubrovnik.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they were absolutely bastards.
Mm.
Then you had the Chetniks, which were the royalists.
Okay.
And Mike Mikhailovich. And they were fighting the Ustashi and the Germans. And they were also fighting the partisans.
Oh, really? They were fighting each other.
It's all very complicated.
Well, it's gone on from there, hasn't it?
And England, when we first started, we supported the Chetniks, but then decided that the partisans were much stronger, so we turned sides and supported the partisans.
Okay.
Because our job was to stop the Germans anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the main enemy, wasn't it?
So I think we were in Yugoslavia for about 8 weeks altogether, that area.
And then Albania then, was it?
And we moved back to Mola de Bari, where we were stationed.
Yeah.
And then the next operation was later on in the year, was in Albania.
And this is when you got taken prisoner?
Huh?
This is when you got taken prisoner?
Yes, I go on that. When we landed at Albania, we did landed with light landing craft infantry again. The actual little beachhead wasn't a very big beach. And they started shelling 88 mils, finding the beach. Mm. The Germans spotted us, you know. Anyway, I was very glad to get off that beach because it's a bit dodgy.
So that's your second beach landing, isn't it, after Italy?
That's in Albania, yeah.
Yeah.
So they gave me a mule because I was a signaller. I said, you've got to go on a forward observation post and send firing orders back to us.
That doesn't sound too safe to me.
So they gave me this bloody mule and the radio set. And me and another fella, who's a sergeant, went up this small mountain.
To see what was going on.
To get to the top so we could overlook Sarandi, where the German transit, the Italian transit camp
was. Yeah.
We were halfway up the mountain. The Germans spotted us, started shelling us again with 88s coming up the mountain.
Yeah.
And then we all just refused to move. Anything stuck solid.
These were the big guns, weren't they? These
88mm. The things, yeah. So we had to tie them to a tree, carry the radio sets up on our backs and batteries.
Yeah.
And we got up to there. Next morning we went down to try to find the mule. We never did find him again.
Oh, really?
It disappeared.
The mule had gone.
So we stuck there sending fire orders back down to the beach. they were firing over mortars over to this transit camp, you know. Unfortunately, the Germans sent out a fighting patrol. Well, not the Germans, the Italians, actually. And about eight men. We was only two, so we had to surrender.
They found you?
Yeah, we managed to destroy a radio set and all the codes and all
that. You knew they were coming, did you?
We saw them coming,
yeah. Saw them coming up the hill. Mm. Yeah. And then what happened to you then? They took you to
a camp? They put us in a blockhouse in this transit camp where the Germans are coming and staying there, being refitted or what it was, and going up. And when we were being questioned, we knew that the next morning the British were going to send over five bloody bombers just dropping pamphlets
to surrender.
But we told them it was going to be bombed. So then we were questioned.
And was it Italians that were questioning you or Germans? Pardon? Was it Italians that were questioning you?
Italians, yeah.
Yeah.
And
Did they believe you?
They just had a guard outside the blockhouse. But a colleague of mine with a sergeant, he had a little ladies' beretti in the soldier put inside his water bottle and sealed.
Okay.
Because they were metal water bottles with cloth covers, as you know. So when the bombing started, he managed to, using his lighter, he managed to melt the soda on his water bottle, took the beretti out, he stuck the guard up, made him open the doors.
Yeah.
We took him inside, gagged him, tied him up and gagged him.
But he was terrified, wasn't he?
Huh?
But he was terrified.
He was terrified and we managed to escape.
Yeah. He got out.
Yeah. But then unfortunately I got malaria. I must have picked the germ up in North Africa.
Yeah.
And I was evacuated to Italy.
Right.
And what happened then?
You said your unit went on to Greece then.
My unit went to Greece. A lot of my colleagues got killed. I felt very guilty because I think I should have been there, you know.
Yeah, survivor's guilt.
And I was in hospital in Taranto, which is part of Italy.
Right.
Italy, southern Italy, rather.
And were you evacuated back to England then?
No. The war was still going on. Nearly ending, and they gave me the job with a couple of others to guard a German prisoner of war camp.
Oh, right.
And I'd be sitting playing cards with these German prisoners.
What were they like?
Oh, they were right. Yeah. Not really friendly with them.
Yeah.
They most of them were Rommel soldiers anyway.
So they were decent soldiers.
They're desert rats.
They weren't SS or anything.
They were desert rats. They were nice blokes. They were just doing their job.
Yeah.
Same as we were.
Yeah.
So we got very friendly, actually, with them.
Yeah. They didn't want to escape, I bet.
No. They were quite happy being prisoners.
They must have been worried about their families at home, though, mustn't they?
They were, of course, worried like everybody else was.
Yeah, you all were.
Yeah.
And so the war is then progressing. Did you know that D-Day had happened when you were out there? Were you aware that D-Day, the invasion of Europe, had happened? Were you getting information?
Oh, we knew that was been going on for some time then.
Yeah, so you knew that we were winning.
The invasion of Europe was in
June 1944.
What date? I'm not quite sure. The date.
June the 6th. So we're coming up to the 80th anniversary of that this year. But you were aware of the bigger picture. You knew what was going on.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's when she called us D-Day Dodgers.
Yeah, right.
Said we were fighting in Italy instead of being on the Western Front.
How did you feel about that?
Well, we'd already done two D-Days before then anyway.
Yeah.
But don't forget that we tied up all the British and the Americans, especially the British, tied up 21 German divisions from going to the Western Front.
Otherwise, they'd have moved them across to France, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's no. We all know that it was a crucial job, and everybody knows that now.
Actually, it was harder fighting there than it was in the Western Front, because very hilly.
It's the terrain, isn't
very
it?
Very mountainous.
Yeah.
And when they, as you know, when Cassino failed, more or less, they moved up and did the Anzio landing on each other. And the Canadians actually were to take Rome.
Mm.
They were the ones that got in first, Canadians. And they, the Americans ordered them to stop because they wanted to go in first.
Right, yeah.
A typical American.
Yeah.
Anyway, because of that, it allowed the Germans to escape, and they managed to get the strength of the Gothic line.
Right.
So when we attacked the Gothic line later on, we lost thousands of men there because it was very, very fortified. So because of that mistake of letting...
delay.
Stopping Canadians going in, they waited for the Americans to go in.
So had you recovered...
gave the Germans a chance to escape.
Had you recovered from malaria by this stage and rejoined the unit?
Oh, yeah, I was recovered from malaria.
Yeah. And where did you end up in 1945, in May 45, when it was VE Day?
Oh, another thing happened actually while I was in Italy. I was evacuated from a hospital at Sorrento.
Yeah.
To a transit camp, actually, on the side of Vesuvius.
Oh, right, yeah.
In March the 7th, 1944.
It erupted, didn't it?
I was on the side of it when it fucking
that
erupted.
Was the last time it erupted.
Yeah.
And if anyone's been to Vesuvius, you can still see the lava that erupted in 19... You were there when that happened.
I was on the side of it, yeah, I was erupted.
How many lives has this man got?
That's what they call me Cat Morris for.
it's like Uncle Albert, it only falls on horses.
That was a
number of people were killed from that eruption, weren't they? A number of people were killed when it erupted.
A lot of people killed, a lot of villages were.
Yeah.
It's the second biggest eruption since Pompeii.
And it hasn't erupted since?
No, it's due to
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, you were there.
I was there, I was actually inside.
Can you describe it, what you saw?
Well, we heard this rumbling and we looked up and saw this big lava rolling down the hill.
Yeah.
And all this stuff floating back, coming down from the sky.
Huh.
So we evacuated, managed to get down off Vesuvius, and they sent us back up again to bring the civilians down.
Right.
But we managed to escape. I managed to escape anyway.
Oh, I bet you did.
That's why I'm still alive.
Yeah.
So don't go on the volcano. Don't go on the volcano anywhere with me.
No,
tends to erupt.
Or a boat.
Ah, yes, because we're going to watch that next.
Don't go on a cruise ship with me because it gets sunk.
That's the next story, isn't it? So the end of the war comes. May 45,
after the war finished.
Yeah.
We were then evacuated back to England.
Okay.
Late 1945.
Yep.
And we went to a place called Borough Bridges, Yorkshire.
Oh, right, yeah.
Our job was then to be trained to be ready to drop into occupied Japanese prisoner of war camps to release the prisoners before they killed them.
So it's not over, is it?
Huh?
No, it's not over.
No, so the war was still going on with Japan.
Yeah.
Anyway, luckily they used the atom bomb and Japan capitulated.
Yeah.
Which stopped us actually going.
Yeah.
Which I was very pleased about.
Yeah, I'll bet, yeah.
And I was actually demobbed, I think, in 1946.
Yeah,
I think
May
46. July 1946.
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't have a job though, did you?
No job.
No.
No career.
So what did you do?
Well, I had a few hundred bucks which I'd won in poking in the housey thing.
So you'd fleeced your mates and decided you had some money to invest, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not very much. They gave us £100 and a new suit.
A demob suit.
D-mob suit, which I sold. We sold it when we got out of the camp to Spiff's bought them
office. Off the black market.
Yeah. That's all. That's the.
So you started.
That's all our generous government gave us, £100 after 6 years.
And a suit. And so then you decided to start a band, is that right?
Well, I first started working afterwards in Kent before I left Kent. I didn't tell you this before, to a company called Hampshire's of Derby.
Yeah.
They actually sold the Zoob, you wouldn't remember those, I don't suppose, Zoob lozenges for throats and snowfire makeup and all that sort of thing.
Okay.
The manufacturing chemists.
Yeah.
And they gave me a job there for some time. I worked for about a year.
Yeah.
And then I decided I didn't like the job very much, and then I decided to move to Bristol because a couple of my mates from my previous regiment, the artillery regiment, who I kept in contact with, had moved to Bristol, and they recommended me to come there, so there's plenty of work there. So I went up to Bristol, got a job as a waylive officer for a company called Rediffusion.
Didn't we used to rent our tellies off then?
Yeah,
I remember that,
And with them for quite some time. And then they decided, they're both musicians, one was a very good drummer. The other one was, they played the guitar, the bass drum.
What about you?
I'm tone deaf, I couldn't play anything.
But you still got, you still were in the band though, even though...
I run the band, I got to really work the manager, for them, I was managing it. It's my band, actually.
I think we're getting the gist of this now.
Supplied the money to start it off with. We finished up with I think it was a 10-piece band altogether.
And it says here you had a really fun
dance
time.
You
enjoyed that then, didn't you?
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
We used to go all over the country.
Yeah.
We travelled all over the West Country.
Right.
We did the Hunt Balls for the Duke of Beaufort.
Yeah.
We're the second biggest band in Bristol.
Oh.
And
you made some money from it?
No,
just fun.
Well, we made money, but not a lot.
No.
Because I think it's... The charge, I think, was $7.06 an hour. $7, £7, 60 cents an hour. Musicians paid then, which wasn't very much money. And a lot of people couldn't afford big bands anyway at that time.
No, no.
And gradually, of course, they went out altogether because the... DJs came in, and you got the three-piece bands, guitar, drums, and probably piano. It's just three-piece bands.
Mm.
If that's all people could afford.
Mm,
so
yeah.
Eventually, we had to pack it up. Then I did various other jobs.
Yeah. So you then, the next thing I wanted to talk about was what happened to you in December 1963. Because I would have thought, having been through all of this, watching volcanoes explode and.
Well, number 63, I did, one of my hobbies I got into, got two good friends made, and they did powerboat racing. And we actually won the British Championship in, I forget the date.
Yeah.
It's in the basket.
Is there a certificate up there somewhere?
It's in the basket, I think.
It's in the basket, I'll show you the photo.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I think it's, I don't think it's been put up. Anyway... We won the British Championship for that year.
Right. Where was that?
And United Kingdom.
Right.
Offshore.
Okay.
Class 3.
Yeah.
And we were presented with a nice globe. I was a co-driver. I got the globe as a navigator. And my mate got the cup as a driver. And so, we were presented by Prince Philip.
Oh, right.
In Grosvenor Hotel.
Yeah.
That was an exciting time, that
I bet. It sounds like after the war, you're having a good time, aren't you? Making sure you enjoy every day. So at what point did you get married?
I can't remember the date, so I got married, a shotgun marriage.
Shotgun marriage.
Actually, it was the boss. When I was Rediffusion, I got very friendly with the boss's secretary, and we had a he said, you know, finished up married, getting married.
Yeah.
And just a daughter, that's all, a daughter.
And was it then your wife's father then paid for you to go to the Canary Islands on the cruise ship?
No, that was the second wife.
That was second wife, was it? Tell us about that, because, I can't believe this story. It's unbelievable.
I'm not going to tell you anything about that. Well, this was finally, after about 7 years, our marriage broke up.
Yeah.
Mainly because I neglected her, I think, more than anything else.
Okay.
Too busy enjoying myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I married again.
Yeah.
To a lovely girl and really in love with her. And unfortunately, while my marriage was with her, we had her father-in-law, or her father, rather, stepfather, paid for a cruise for us to go to the Canary Islands on Christmas in 19, 63, I think it was.
Yeah.
60 years ago, anyway, would that be what?
Yeah, 63. Yeah, just Christmas just gone, yeah.
A Christmas cruise on a Greek ship. Unfortunately, in December 23, it caught on fire.
Where were you when this happened? Out at sea?
Just off of Casablanca, not far from Casablanca.
Okay.
It got so bad they had to evacuate the ship, so...
Your wife was pregnant at the time?
She was pregnant and also had a little boy of 3 years old.
Yeah.
Anyway, I tried to get back to... I was actually... My wife and I were actually in the ballroom just having dinner and all that sort of thing.
Mm.
And our little boy was in the cabin, in the stateroom, actually. And there's a girl outside who had to stroll up and down, looking after all the cabins, making sure the kids were all right.
Mm.
Anyway, when it started to caught on fire, she scarpered, left the kids.
Did she? She ran for herself, yeah.
And I tried to get back in to save my son, who was only 3 years old.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the cabins, I couldn't get in because of smoke. I had no smoke.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get through the smoke, and I couldn't even find where the cabin was because I hadn't hardly been on the ship very long. Anyway, a German sailor came up. He said, "What's wrong?" I told him where my son was, and he said, "Don't worry, sir." He said, "I'll go and find him for you." And he had a mask over his face, and he went and brought my son and saved my son's
life. Out of the cabin?
Yeah.
So after all those years fighting the Germans...
Pardon?
After all those years in the Second World War fighting the Germans, it's a German sailor that saves your son.
He's a fantastic...
The irony, isn't it, of life, you know, makes you realise war is so
sad. Anyway, I was very grateful to him, and I wish I'd taken his name and address, but I didn't.
Mm, yeah. Think of it at the time.
I don't know if he survived or not, because a lot of my crew were killed as well. Anyway, I managed to get my family, apart from my mother-in-law, not my wife's mother, rather, on one lifeboat. And I tried to get my wife's mother on the lifeboat. They said there's no more room. So I went and put her on another lifeboat. Unfortunately, the extra lifeboat, when it had been lowered, the davits snapped and they tipped the boat into the water and everybody was drowned, including my mother and my wife's mother. Yeah.
I never found a body.
Never found a body.
No.
And actually, I was in the water for 6 hours myself.
You didn't have a life jacket on, did you?
No life jacket.
Yeah. How did you survive? How were you clinging on to something?
I slung onto a bit of driftwood.
Yeah.
Cargo stuff on the deck cargo, what it was.
Yeah.
I managed to hang on to that, and I managed to pull somebody else with me on board.
Yeah.
Saved his life.
Yeah.
And we had 6 hours in the water.
I bet it was freezing cold as well, wasn't it?
It wasn't all that warm.
No.
But it was a bit pissed, mind you, because the bar was open on the ship when they...
So you went in the bar before you got off the ship,
did
you?
We had a few brandies, yeah.
Did you pay the bill?
And I walked down the gangplank, just walked in the water.
You'll probably get a bill for that at some stage.
Plate your shoes, tuxedo, looking very smart.
Were you? You dressed for dinner.
And when I got a ship called the Montcalm picked us up.
Yeah.
It's a Canadian ship. And when we got on board, all these bodies were on deck.
Really?
Tarpaulins over them.
It does sound like the Titanic, doesn't it? Similar story.
There's 128 people killed, actually.
Really?
Died on that ship.
So once again...
Pardon?
Once again, you've survived, haven't you?
Yeah, survived.
Yeah.
So don't go on a ship with me.
No. When he told us that story last month, I remember 2 weeks later I was going on a cruise.
You
I was terrified. I checked the list to make sure he wasn't on it. Oh no, it's not funny, is it? It's a relief to come through that, isn't it? So many different scrapes you had.
Yeah, well, I've had lots of scrapes. I've had two or three very major car accidents, which were...
Were you driving?
Which I was driving, yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't a very good driver, Dave.
It's safer sat in here, isn't it, on this bed?
Anyway...
Don't believe it.
So with one thing and another, I suppose, I've only got about one life left, I think.
Well, you're coming up to 102 now, and you're here in the Royal Hospital in Chelsea. Yeah. What's it like living here? You went off, I know you said you went off to Australia.
I'll tell you a bit about that. Finished up that my marriage broke up, and had a business in England. I first of all, a state agency business, which when the Labour Party got back in again and they caused a very bad financial situation here. If you remember, the loans and saw block credit.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had a state agency business doing very, very well.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get mortgages.
Yeah.
So I finished up paying all the bills and finished up without any money myself. Trying to keep the business going, sold it for peanuts.
Mm.
And after another failure of marriage, which I don't want to go into, I also went to Mallorca and bought a restaurant over there. Well, what happened was this, that I went over there for holiday and I wanted to look for getting a business. When I was coming back in the aircraft, flying back to Bristol, I sat to a chap called Christopher Lloyd, and he actually ran a travel agency in Bristol called Gulliver's Travels.
Oh, yeah. They're still going. They do sports tours, don't they?
So he said to me, what are you doing here, John? What are you doing over here? What did you go to Mallorca for? I said, I went on holiday, but I was actually looking for a business. He said, well, I just built a motel. He said, would you be interested in taking over the restaurant and the supermarket? I said, I'd be interested. I said, I'll come back and have a look at it. So a couple of weeks later, I went back with him, looked at the place, liked it, and he signed up to run this restaurant, five-star restaurant, silver service and everything. I was doing very, very well. I had very good terms with the owner. I didn't have any set rent to pay. He said, just give me a percentage of your net turnover. After, so that's how it worked it out.
Like,
I think it's 10% of my net turnover.
Mm.
Anyway, he's decided to build another motel next to the one I was in. Unfortunately, he got into a financial situation and had to go into liquidation, got into debt. And Franco was actually in charge of Spain at the time. They sent the police in, closed us down, took all my stock. I had about £20,000 worth of stock ready for the summer, you know, which I'd bought wine and all that sort of thing for the restaurant. And they just closed me down, took everything I had. And so I had to go back to England again. Anyway, after a few disasters in life, I decided to go to Australia, where my daughter was. And my marriage broke up. And that's really, I stayed there. I got there in 1988 and I stayed there until 2 years ago.
2022,
21. And I gave up work when I was 98.
Really? That's what's kept you going then, isn't it?
I got a job. People say they can't get work.
There's always work, isn't there?
I got, my last job was with a company in Sydney, a solar company, and I got a job with them when I was 85.
Doing what?
As a consultant.
Selling?
Yeah.
I can imagine you could sell.
And I worked until 98 when the corona came along.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I gave up work then.
Yeah, don't blame you. That's what finished me off as well. I think a lot of people gave up work during that period.
Then my partner, who I'd been with for 35 years.
In Australia.
We were just friends, but she looked after me, I looked after her.
Yeah.
I'm still looking after her, actually. I still send her money every month to keep her. She decided she couldn't look after me anymore, and a friend of mine came over, Jim Kearney, Colonel Jim Kearney in the SAS. Came to see me one day, he took me to the disabled games, you know. Got very friendly with them. And he sort of knew my situation. And him and another friend of his was Matt Hellerin, decided that it was a good idea if I came to England and they organised me to come here. And they arranged the finance and everything with the Daily Mirror. They helped. And they paid my fare for business class. And the American, the Australian Army actually supplied an airborne corporal to come with me.
Keep an eye on your spec.
Well, because I was reckoned I could trouble on my own, you know.
In case there's a plane crash.
Yeah, he paid business class as well. They paid business class.
They wouldn't let him come on the boat.
But apart from the food here, it's very, very wonderful place to be.
Yeah, you always seem very relaxed here, don't you? And you've got a lot of friends here.
Oh, I've got more friends than I've had in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, so a wonderful community, isn't
this
it?
This one's a pain in the arse, but he's all right.
He's not listening to you.
I know what you're talking about, I've heard it.
He's been a good mate, yes. No, I got to, one day last week, I had 15 businesses in one day.
Really? Wow. Not all at the same time, I hope. Yeah. Well, you're very well known, aren't you? You're even more well known when this podcast goes out. Well, thank you very much. It's going to. We talked
for. Was that enough for you? He's joined the.
He was in the Air Force, did you say, your brother?
He became a bomber pilot.
Yeah.
And then on his first raid over Germany, he was shot down.
Yeah, over Cologne, you said?
Over Cologne. He's only going as second pilot, as a sort of a passenger.
And what plane was he in?
In a Lancaster.
Right.
Yeah.
And it crash-landed?
Crash-landed.
Did they all survive, all seven of them?
There were five. There were five in there.
Actually. Five in there, were they?
I think it was five, yeah. They all taken prisoner.
Right.
He was in Stalag Lift 3, where the big escape took place.
Yeah.
He was also in Stalag 8B, where he finished up.
Right.
He escaped twice himself, and he's also awarded the... made a member of the British FBO.
Sounds like it runs in the family, this.
For organising escape routes.
Yeah, he was a troublemaker then.
No, he was a troublemaker.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we get the gist of this, don't we, Rob?
In the blood, isn't it?
So, you said to me just now that the Daily Mirror, when they brought you back from Australia, you said that they called you a hero.
Well, when they brought me back, the newspaper said, bringing the hero home.
And what did you feel about that?
Well, I don't consider myself a hero, anybody else. I think any person who volunteered, especially in a major war like the Second World War, the First World War, and any war, they volunteer willing to risk their lives. Whether they do or not, it's up to them, but they are available to risk their lives.
Mm.
Anybody willing to lift, patriotic enough to want to lift, to risk their lives for their country, in my opinion, are heroes.
Do you regret it? Do you regret volunteering?
I'm disgusted the way I was, the Second World War veterans were treated by the UK afterwards.
After the war, yeah.
They were completely forgotten.
Yeah. Do you feel that the British public understand what you went through, people of our generation?
I don't think so. They don't care, Dan.
Well, we're certainly, our generation and everybody that I know is grateful for the service that you gave us.
I wish I could do more of it. I'd been talking to a couple of schools, telling the kids, because I think kids should know more about
very much so, yeah.
This great sacrifice was made by the forefathers.
Yeah, for them to live the life.
They don't understand it, half of them.
And do they understand when you've been in and talked to them?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they do respond. And I think this is true, isn't it? That the young generation do
want to. I went to school, actually, this year.
Yeah.
I've been there twice. And I was going into a classroom to talk to the children. And the teacher said, oh, we've just been talking about volcanoes.
He's an expert on that as well.
So I said, all right. I said, it's on the volcano in eruption. She said, oh, she's coming to tell the children, she said. So that's amazing, that wasn't it?
Yeah.
Coincidence, I didn't know you were there.
No,
I'd like to go to the schools. I think kids should know more about
very much so,
the great sacrifices made by their forefathers.
For them to live the life that they do, yeah. And I do find that, you know, I take schools on tours, battlefield tours. When you get them there, they are very interested. So that was it. I hope you enjoyed that special episode today. It's not often to get a chance to talk to a veteran from the Second World War. And John, as you could see, was such a colourful and entertaining character. I thought it would be useful to play that for you early this week. And there'll be another podcast out later this week when we return to World War One. And we're going to go back to a battle that we talked about 18 months ago at Fromelles. And we're going to talk to the Australian amateur historian who uncovered the story of the 250 Australians that were buried by the Germans at Pheasant Wood and then recovered about 15, 16 years ago now. We've got a special interview with him, and that's coming up, as I say, later this week. So thank you very much for tuning in to this podcast, and we'll speak again very soon. And as usual, we will think of all of the comrades that John served with that died during the campaign in North Africa and the Balkans and Italy, and those that died in the Blitz as well in the Second World War. We do that by playing The Last Post.